Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, Jose Nino. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program featuring contributors to the Barnes Review Revisionist History Magazine, a bi-monthly politically incorrect print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. For those interested, we are offering a free sample PDF of the March-April issue and a sample print issue of the Barnes Review. But if you want to fully subscribe to our magazine, visit our website, barnesreview.com. The website is your one-stop shop for revisionist history, which boasts a selection of over 400 revisionist history books. To take advantage of any of these offers, visit barnesreview.com, email sales@barnesreview.org, or call toll-free 1-877-773-9077, Monday to Thursday, 8 to 4 Eastern Time. To get your sample print issue of the Barnes Review, send a $5 postage to the Barnes Review at P.O. Box 550 White Plains, Maryland 20695. Welcome back to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, Jose Nino. Today, I have the honor of having on Ron Unz, the founder, publisher, and editor-in-chief of the Unz Review. I figured I would have you on, Ron, because you put out great content that aligns very much with the mission of the Barnes Review. And in fact, you've mentioned the Harry Elmer Barnes in particular, our namesake, in your articles. But just give us a brief overview of like your career and what you're doing at the Unz Review these days.
Sure. Well, my original background was actually in the sciences. I was a theoretical physicist by training. But then I got involved in computer software, basically in the mid-1980s, and spent some time in that. And then afterwards, by the 1990s, I was much more heavily involved in politics and public policy, basically running some initiative campaigns and things like that after I'd moved back to California. And I'd always been very interested in public policy issues. And so really for the last 20 or so years, that's been my main focus. In other words, doing research, writing, and in particular, founding this webzine publication, the Unz Review, partly as a venue for my own writings or for other writings that are really sort of too controversial to be contained within the mainstream media. In other words, in a sense, the orientation of our website is those controversial or important topics that are generally excluded from the mainstream media. And actually, as the years have gone by, the number of things excluded from the mainstream media seems to have grown dramatically, so that, you know, more and more of the sort of material we probably include is, broader and broader in content. And so my own writings have generally been focused more, at least in the last 10 or 15 years, more on the history of the last 100 or 200 years and the extent to which much of what is portrayed in our media is really a very unrealistic version of what actually happened. And one other thing I should mention is about 20 years ago in the early 2000s, I got involved in a software project which was based on the idea of digitizing the archives of a lot of the leading publications in American history. I mean, the sort of mainstream influential publications that, you know, were really considered very important in the era in which they were published. And as I started digitizing them, you know, their archives, I really noticed that many of the stories they contained, which again had been, you know, very mainstream elite publications at the time they ran, were very different than what I had always been taught about that era. So in other words, it really struck me that much of what I'd learned in my college classes and my history books and in the media was very different than what the people at the time reading the most mainstream elite publications of that era believed to be the case. And so, you know, that really was one of the factors that led me to sort of start, you know, questioning what I'd always believed about the history of the world for the last century or two. And that's really most of what I've been working on since then.
Were there any books or even historical figures that really prompted you to delve into historical revisionism?
Well, really quite a lot of them. And again, a lot of it came when I was digitizing all these old publications. In fact, a perfect example is Harry Elmer Barnes, you know, your namesake. In other words, I'd sort of, you know, when I'd browsed around the internet, I'd always gotten the impression that Barnes was some sort of fringe figure, a sort of fringe activist, you know, and I really had sort of casual acquaintance with him and his ideas. And then when I started digitizing the archives, I mean, I discovered he was one of the leading editors of Foreign Affairs, one of the most influential publications in America at the time it was founded. I mean, he had hundreds of articles appearing in the New Republic, The Nation, Foreign Affairs, all of these leading publications during that period. I mean, he was, you know, one of the most influential academics and intellectuals of the 1920s and 1930s. And the same thing with someone like John T. Flynn. I'd always sort of viewed him as some sort of fringe right winger. And then I discovered that he actually had been one of the leading progressive columnists in America for decades. I mean, he was one of the key figures at the New Republic throughout the 1930s. And so, you know, when you find that individuals you'd always perceived as being sort of very marginal fringe figures with eccentric ideas were actually some of the most influential mainstream figures in American intellectual life, it really raises a lot of questions in our mind. And, you know, I've written some articles, obviously, focusing on those individuals and a number of other individuals and how, in effect, the United States in the very late 1930s or 1940 actually underwent its own great purge, much like the Soviet Union did. Except in the case of the United States, the individuals who were purged weren't shot or sent to the gulag. They were simply excluded from the mainstream media. So they disappeared from the reality of most people's consciousness. And, you know, after 10 or 20 years, most people had really forgotten about them. So it's just a very strange thing when you come across individuals who, you know, were so influential and important at the time in the most mainstream elite publications in the United States, and you'd never heard of them. I mean, you'd gone to college, you'd read, you know, all your textbooks, you'd taken history courses, and they were totally unknown to you in many cases. And so that really started me being much more open to a reevaluation of what I understood, you know, of the history of the last 100 years or 200 years.
That's a very interesting point you raised there about the time period in question, the 1930s and 1940s, because that's obviously the New Deal, World War II era. I would assume that, based on your research, that the reason these people were canceled, what, quote unquote, actually, it's a form of proto-cancel culture, if you will, was because of their views and interpretations of World War II, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Oh, that's entirely correct. That's exactly correct. And, you know, again, there was sort of a huge purge of American journalism and intellectual life. In fact, you know, some letters were actually found where, for example, Franklin Roosevelt sent out letters to editors demanding that they fire these individuals and refuse to publish anything that they would write. And, you know, that's basically what happened to them. I mean, they were sort of purged from the media. And the key point is, and that's actually why I call my long series American Pravda, the media defines most of our reality. In other words, what we know of the world, except for our own day-to-day personal experiences, comes through the filter of the media. And if you can shape the media in a certain way, if you can exclude certain perspectives from the media, if you can ban certain individuals or intellectuals from the media, you've really reshaped the reality of the world for the vast majority of Americans. And that's exactly what happened. So, you know, just as, for example, the old Soviet Pravda was, you know, a propaganda organ that provided really a very distorted, unrealistic, ideologically tainted view of the world. You know, the American media, in many respects, has been our American Pravda. And I mean, that was the original article I published back about a dozen years ago, which became the entire series. And, you know, as I started going through more and more different historical events, I mean, certainly one of the most significant is the period leading up to the Second World War and America's entrance into the Second World War. Because, you know, obviously at the time that was happening, the polls showed that about 80% of the American public were opposed to American involvement in the Second World War. I mean, that had been also the very mainstream position for years, from really throughout the 1930s, that we'd made a disastrous mistake getting involved in the First World War, and we must make sure it never would happen again. And yet, within a period of a few years, that entire public viewpoint was turned around through massive propaganda, the purge of voices on the other side, and, you know, basically a sort of one-sided perspective of what was happening. So, I mean, certainly the Second World War is one of the biggest examples of that, but there are many other examples that pretty much govern a lot of American history. And, I mean, it's sort of, you know, the whole thing about it is when you start finding a few of these examples and you track them down, you carefully go through them, you verify the fact that these claims people made at the time, you know, seem to be correct. And, I mean, you look at the headlines of the leading publications at the time and what they say is totally different than what your history books say. You know, that leaves you much more open to the possibility of similar things happening in other events. And so, you know, the Second World War is certainly one of the biggest examples of that, but there are many, many other examples as well. And, you know, I'm sure that's also happened with many other countries around the world. But I think one difference is my sense is that the individuals in most other, say, European countries have a more cynical view of their government traditionally and their media. In other words, they sort of assume their government is dishonest. They assume that their media is dishonest. They assume that a lot of what they're getting is simply propaganda. While for a long time, I think in the United States, there was more of naive belief that the government was sort of honest and decent and would never, you know, lie on certain things, and that the media tended to accurately report, you know, at least to a reasonable extent, what was going on. And, you know, once you find out that's not the case and has not been the case on so many different examples in history, you know, just then become much, much more cautious about believing what the media is telling you right now. And it works the other way around. In other words, in the last few years, I think with Russiagate and some of the related events, a lot of Americans have become much more suspicious and cynical of what the media is telling them about the world. And because they're skeptical of what the media is telling them now, I, you know, point out to them, if they don't believe what they're being told about the world right now, you know, they should obviously be much more cautious about believing what happened long ago and far away, you know, in the distant past. And I think that's why there's much more of an opening for people to start reassessing a lot of what they've been taught.
In addition to World War II, what are some other issues that have become taboo and have effectively been memory hold in the discourse based on what you have been able to compile in your UNS review catalog?
Well, I mean, there are really quite a few of them. I mean, another obvious example, you know, very relevant in today's world, is the whole Middle Eastern conflict, you know, the Israel-Palestine conflict, all of those sorts of things. In other words, you know, I think people are becoming, partly because of social media, TikTok, you know, Elon Musk's Twitter, people are becoming much more doubtful about what the mainstream media told them for, you know, 40 or 50 or 60 years. But until fairly recently, people had a very, very, most Americans had a very, very one-sided view of the Middle Eastern conflict with regard to, you know, Israel and the Palestinians. And, you know, again, I mean, it's sort of, the whole thing about it is when everything people get in their newspapers, in their magazines, in radio broadcasts, in movies, in television, if all of that frames the events in a particular way and all of it seems to agree, it's naturally very difficult for people to believe that what they're really being fed is, you know, largely propaganda. In other words, you know, if there's a disagreement, in other words, if 3/4 of the media says one thing, but 1/4 says another thing, you know, people can sort of try to winnow out what sounds more plausible, you know, check the facts. But if everything people are told from every different media source supports the same picture of reality, it's very difficult for most ordinary people to simply believe that that's simply a propaganda construct. And, you know, and when you have a few people possibly who have either a personal connection to the region or have traveled there or have better information or just are sort of, you know, people who get their information from entirely different sorts of sources, if they say something different, you know, they're regarded as like cranks or kooks or fringe nuts or that sort of thing. And so, you know, it takes a while for people to recognize that, you know, the media could be entirely unified on something, but entirely unified in a dishonest or propagandistic sort of way. And I mean, you know, again, it's much less now in some ways than it would have been probably 20 or 30 years ago. But take, for example, the whole Russia-Ukraine conflict. You know, I mean, right now on YouTube, it's fairly easy to find some, you know, major channels that have leading, highly credible American journalists, academics, scholars, former government officials, former national security officials. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, Andrew Napolitano's channel or a few of these other channels that provide a very, very different view of the Ukraine conflict, or for that matter, the Middle Eastern conflict, than you get through the mainstream media. And, you know, once you sort of see that, I mean, the fact that, for example, you know, every mainstream media source for the last 3 years has constantly said the Russian invasion of Ukraine was entirely unprovoked. You know, it's a party line. I mean, it's repeated thousands and thousands of times in every media outlet. When anybody who's paid the least attention to the conflict and has looked into it can see it was massively provoked. I mean, it was provoked by the American coup that we staged in Ukraine in 2014. It was provoked by, you know, the efforts to get Ukraine to join NATO. It was provoked by all these sorts of things. So, you know, again, I mean, people can argue about whether the Russian invasion was justified or not. But to describe it as unprovoked is just utterly, utterly ridiculous. I mean, it's as ridiculous as the worst sort of old Soviet propaganda in the Stalinist era. You know, when people were told, oh, yes, you know, we have plenty of meat in all the shops, and you would go to the shops and there wouldn't be any meat there. So, you know, again, it's just a very, you know, without YouTube, without the internet, without social media, it would be much, much, much more difficult for people to acquire a more realistic view of the current events in the world, let alone the events of, you know, 50 or 100 years ago. And I mean, one point I make to people is take something like the New York Times. I mean, I personally think its quality has sharply declined in the last 10 years or so. But, you know, it's still, I mean, it represents mainstream, respectable, elite opinion in the United States. I mean, you know, whether it's right or not, I mean, it's the mainstream, elite, respectable opinion. And, you know, if you take, for example, the articles you could have seen on major issues in the New York Times 50 years ago, and 50 years ago, the New York Times was probably even more representative of mainstream, elite, conventional wisdom thinking in the United States. A lot of the articles that appeared in the New York Times 50 years ago, if anybody would try to publish them in the New York Times today, they would be ridiculed, they would be vilified, they would be denounced, it would be considered like a fringe lunatic sort of idea. And in the same way, if you took some of the articles in the New York Times today and tried to publish them in the New York Times of 50 years ago, it would be exactly the same reaction. There would be a feeling this is like stuff from a lunatic asylum. I mean, crazy fringe nonsense. So, you know, again, there is no way the New York Times can be right both 50 years ago and today, you know, when they're talking about the same events or the same ideological views, So the truth is probably neither of those perspectives is exactly right, but they can't both be right. So it just something like that simply proves that the notion of mainstream respectable views being necessarily correct cannot be true, because the mainstream respectable views from 50 years ago are exactly the opposite today in some areas and vice versa. And so that's simply, it would be, for example, if you had, you know, say in the old Soviet Union, if there had been a battle between Stalin and Trotsky over who would run the country, and if Trotsky had won, obviously all the Stalinists would have been purged from Pravda, and they would have been sent off to the Gulag or something like that. And so Pravda's party line would have been entirely different than what it became under Stalin. And so, you know, that simply means that it's very foolish to regard Pravda's party line as being some sacred thing that you have to believe in. And exactly the same way in the United States, it's very foolish to regard the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or any of these other media outlets as being something you have to necessarily believe in, since its party line has changed so dramatically over the decades.
You mentioned the New York Times because we were focusing a lot on individuals that were once prominent and respected members of American society, but then fell from grace due to pressure from the top. Were there any media outlets in the early to mid 20th century that were not just respectable, but had readerships that were on par with like the leading mainstream outlets, but then fell out of favor because they platformed several controversial writers or touched on issues that were considered, that were deemed taboo by the ruling class?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, in most cases, the media outlets have not been purged, but the personnel of the media outlets have sometimes been purged. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, in a sense, if they platformed certain people or if they took a certain line, sometimes a huge amount of pressure was exerted for them to change their party line. And, you know, personnel were changed and then they shifted. I mean, a perfect example of that, in fact, leading up to the case of the Second World War, is the case of The Nation. I mean, The Nation really, you know, for really most of its existence had been one of the leading left-wing or liberal publications in the United States. The owner of The Nation for decades had been one of the leading left-wing liberal intellectuals in the United States. I mean, a very, very prominent figure. And he ended up being, he was very strongly opposed to American entrance into the Second World War. So, for example, his column in his own publication, he ended up actually selling the publication in 1935. And, you know, after he sold the publication, obviously his column still continued there because he'd been running it for decades. And then as, you know, America, as sort of the party line of the liberal establishment or the progressive establishment shifted more towards American involvement in the Second World War, he was purged from his own publication, which, you know, is just sort of,
oh, wow,
you know, a dramatic change like that. I mean, again, he'd, you know, been the owner of it. And the same thing, for example, I mean, in fact, one reason I sort of mentioned in one of my articles is something very similar. It actually happened in The Nation in the last few years. For example, lead owner and the publisher of The Nation for the last probably 30 years, 40 years was Katrina Vandenhoevel. And her husband, her second husband, or actually her husband, but his second wife, was one of the leading left-wing intellectuals specializing in Russia efforts in the United States. And he'd basically been, you know, a Princeton professor, then New York University professor. I mean, he was sort of a leading Russia scholar. And among Russia scholars, he was one of the few who was really a dyed-in-the-wool leftist, you know, a hardline really leftist. I mean, he'd been writing a column in The Nation going back to the 1970s. So, I mean, he was, you know, really, if you were a leftist in the United States with a view on Russia, he was the individual whom you really would follow. He was the husband.
Stephen Cohen?
Of course, Stephen Cohen. Anyway, you know, Princeton University, New York University, I'm a leading scholar. And it was really shocking that, you know, as this break developed with Russia under Putin the last few years, especially with the war in the Ukraine and a few years leading up to it, you know, we're talking about the leading figure on the left, who was an expert on Russia going back decades. His wife was the publisher of The Nation, and he couldn't get his own articles published in The Nation. And there was such a, legally he could, because his wife was the publisher. She was the main owner of The Nation. But when he tried to publish something, there was such a ferocious backlash against him because, you know, again, the left wing in America had become so incredibly hostile towards Putin, towards Trump, Russiagate, all that sort of nonsense. That, I mean, basically, once every 3 months or so, he would run a short piece in The Nation, and there would be a huge amount of vilification, attacking him, denouncing him. And so he was essentially purged from his own publication. One ironic thing is that one of his few remaining media outlets was one of his former students had become a syndicated radio talk host, John Batchelor, based in New York, but syndicated around the country on CBS. And so once a week or so, he would do an hour-long show on Batchelor's, you know, outlet and, you know, get his ideas out there. I mean, and he was very concerned about what was going on in Russia. I mean, he said we were in a situation in many ways as dangerous or more dangerous than we'd been during the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, with basically fighting a proxy war with nuclear-armed Russia on Russia's own border. It was just crazy. And, I mean, his whole career for decades had been aimed at fostering good relations between the Soviet Union and then Russia and the United States. And suddenly, towards the end of his life, it was all coming apart. There was nothing he could do about it. So we ended up actually then getting his permission to rerun some of his columns and especially rerun links to his shows. And we probably, the Unsreview, my small publication, probably got him more attention than in his own Nation publication, where his wife was the publisher. By the way, that other person I was talking about was Garrison.
Yeah, William Lloyd Garrison.
William Lloyd Garrison, he was the abolitionist. And then his grandson was Garrison Villard. He'd been the owner of the Nation for about 20 years. And then, you know, he sold it in 1935. So the point about it is, when you have a sort of sweeping tide of, you know, a massive ideological shift in an entire movement, as in, for example, the American left or progressives regarding Russia and Putin, you know, no matter how prominent you are, no matter how influential you have been, even if your wife is the publisher of the flagship media organ of the American left, there's still sometimes very little you can do to sort of halt that tide. And that's exactly what people like John T. Flynn, like Harry Elmer Barnes, like Charles Beard, like so many of the other people really encountered in the late 1930s and the early 1940s. I mean, in other words, they were sort of swept away by this huge ideological tide, pretty much fostered and promoted by, you know, Franklin Roosevelt and by, you know, obviously the Jewish groups in the United States and also by the British. In fact, one thing I only discovered about 12 or 15 years ago, which is really shocking to me, is that many of the political shifts that took place in the early 1940s in the United States, including political shifts, you know, in terms of people winning or losing office or being selected, actually seem to have been very heavily influenced by the machinations of British intelligence. In other words, I'd never dream that British intelligence had such a powerful role in the United States. You know, I was obviously aware that there was a very powerful network of Soviet spies, you know, the Venona decrypts and everything like that. I mean, that was very well known. But apparently in around 1940, 1939, 1941, the early 1940s, there was a very powerful, entirely hidden effort by the British intelligence service to simply shift American political life in a way that would help bring America into the war on Britain's behalf. And one of the most dramatic examples of that, which is, you know, again, covered in a monograph by seemed a very solid scholar who'd done all the archival research and everything like that. You know, in 1940, and there was an article of mine, I've written a few articles on it, but recently I wrote an article on obviously Charles Lindbergh and, you know, the America First movement in 1940 and 1941. But the really shocking thing is that in 1939, late 1930s, 1940, a very large majority of the American public was absolutely opposed to American involvement in the Second World War, even after the war broke out. I mean, the polls seem to show about 80% of the American public was opposed to American entrance into the war. Now, that was especially strong within the Republican Party. In other words, in the Republican Party, it was probably closer to 90% or something like that. So, you know, we're talking about the 1940 election coming up. Franklin Roosevelt was thinking of running for an unprecedented third term. I mean, something no president had ever done in the past. And, you know, there was a strong feeling that was really contrary to, you know, the American tradition. So he was facing potentially a very difficult reelection fight in 1940. He was also then in a situation where he was doing everything he could to get America involved in the Second World War on the Allied side. But, you know, considering the fact that he probably would be running against a Republican who was absolutely opposed to American entrance into the war, it would have put Roosevelt in a very difficult position, because either Roosevelt would have to make the strongest possible declarations that in no way, under no circumstances, would he get America involved in any military conflict, or he very well could have been defeated. So in other words, you know, what he slurred as the isolationists entirely dominated the Republican Party, and he'd be facing a very difficult run for a third term against an isolationist Republican. Yet what actually ended up happening is the Republican Party ended up nominating an interventionist Democrat as its presidential nominee. I mean, it's just utterly bizarre. I mean, I'd never really studied that period of American history. You know, there might have been a sentence or two in the history books, but that's about it. So, I mean, we're talking about the situation where the Republicans nominated a man who'd been a card-carrying Democrat, a strongly committed Democrat, until a few months before he was selected as the Republican nominee. And it turns out that seems to have been entirely arranged by the hidden efforts of British intelligence agents. I mean, it's just bizarre. And, you know, obviously, none of it came out in the media at the time. It, you know, was only discovered decades later as memoirs were written, as, you know, more detailed histories books were written, as historians went through and looked through the archives. And, you know, I mean, many of the key files had been weeded out of the archives. But, I mean, and the individual was Wendell Willkie. I mean, you know, when I'd read my history books, the name Wendell Willkie had always come up. He'd been a, you know, the Republican nominee who ran,
afterthought,
who ran against Franklin Roosevelt in 1940 and lost, you know, in a landslide and everything like that. I just thought Wendell Willkie. And there might have been some, like, sentence here saying that, oh, he'd been a Democrat. But what I hadn't realized is, A, he was a very obscure individual. In other words, virtually no Republicans had ever heard of him. B, he'd been a Democrat until just a few months before he received the Republican presidential nomination. And C, he was an interventionist Democrat. So in other words, the reason Roosevelt was able to win an easy third term is because he was in effect running against a Me Too Democrat whom the Republicans had been manipulated into nominating. And, you know, at the time, I mean, a lot of the key journalists at the time said it was the strangest thing they'd ever heard of. In fact, I think it might have been Mencken who said, you know, it must have been like divine intervention or something like that for the Republicans to have picked a totally obscure Democrat as their presidential nominee. But actually, a lot of it had to, obviously, it wasn't the only factor. There certainly were very powerful Republican business interests on the East Coast. The East Coast establishment was very eager to have American involved in the Second World War. And, you know, they were on the other side. They more leaned towards Roosevelt's interventionist position. So it wasn't that there were no Republicans on that side. But, I mean, they were a very decided minority of the Republican Party, especially the activist Republican Party. And they through the intervention of British intelligence. And in fact, I mean, we're talking, I mean, the book that covers it, the monograph that covers it, called Desperate Deceptions. It was published, I think, about 20 years ago. I mean, a very solid academic monograph, mainstream publication. I mean, the individual, I mean, there really is a reasonable amount of evidence that not only were underhanded tactics used by British intelligence, but they actually may have murdered some of the people who stood in their way. In other words, they may have basically just assassinated some of the key figures in the Republican Party, killed them, who basically would have blocked Wilkie's nomination. And just to give you one example, the manager of the Republican convention at the time was a diehard supporter of, I guess it was probably Taft as being the main candidate, and he suddenly dropped dead in the middle of the convention. And I mean,
wow.
Yeah, so and the man who replaced him then was somebody who was entirely committed to Wilkie. And, you know, when you're the manager of the convention, for example, a lot of tickets were forged. There were a lot of bribes paid. There was a lot of underhanded manipulation going on. But it's a lot easier to do that if you control the convention. And that's basically what happened. So, I mean, we're talking about, you know, events that might not be shocking if we read about them, for example, in ancient Rome or in the Ottoman Empire, things like that. But to be aware that there's a very good chance that they happened, I mean, a generation or two ago in the United States and simply were totally ignored by the history books or by, you know, introductory textbooks or by the media. I mean, that, you know, that makes you much more cautious about believing a lot of other things. So, you know, the way it works with a lot of these issues is once you really have convinced yourself, and it takes sometimes a good deal of convincing, because again, if you come from a mainstream background, I mean, you say to yourself, this couldn't possibly be true. But then when you read it, when you read all these books, when you discover, for example, that some of these individuals who wrote these books had been the leading public intellectuals in the United States, the leading journalists. I mean, for example, in the case of John T. Flynn, you know, I checked and there were 400 columns he'd published in the New Republic before he was purged. And so we're not talking about a fringe figure. And so when you see all of that happening and you convince yourself that this alternative version of reality is probably correct, it obviously makes you much more open-minded when you come across other possibilities like that. And that's really the key point I'd made in my original American Pravda article, that once you come across a few of these examples, you're much more willing to consider others. In fact, one of probably the earliest cases I came across that was, you know, just utterly shocking. I'm not sure how much you remember, but back in the Vietnam War, there was a big controversy over the POWs and the MIAs. You may have heard about it or something.
Yeah, vaguely. Yeah.
Anyway, you know, there were all these fringe groups that basically claimed that the Vietnamese had not returned all of our POWs when the war ended. I mean, it was just sort of crazy fringe nonsense. I would, you know, occasionally see them mentioned in the media. It was just sort of, I mean, it was almost the equivalent of like the QAnon movement, where there are all these crazy activists saying all these crazy things. I never paid any attention to them. And, you know, obviously all the publications I read, all the mainstream publications just ridiculed it, debunked it, and everything like that. And then probably, I guess it was about 15 years ago, I just was clicking a link on a website and I came across an article, a very detailed article, basically saying that all of that was entirely true. And I thought, that's crazy article on the internet. And I looked at the name of the person who wrote it. And the name sort of Sidney Schoenberg. I thought, oh yeah, that name, you know, that seems a little bit familiar to me. And I checked, and Sidney Schoenberg was the Pulitzer Prize winning New York Times reporter.
Wow.
Whose story was made into The Killing Fields, which was, you know, one of the classic Vietnam War films that won an Oscar. In other words, not only that, he was one of the highest ranking New York Times editors. I mean, a third of all the journalists at the New York Times reported to him. I mean, he was one of the most prominent journalists in the United States. And in fact, you know, later on, I mean, he ended up publishing a collection of his writings. And, you know, a number of the people who wrote blurbs for it said that, you know, he clearly was one of the greatest wartime correspondents of the one of the greatest American wartime correspondents of the 20th century. And he'd written this very long, detailed article. I think 7,000 or 8,000 words, drawing on all this information, basically saying that the POW story was entirely true. And then I checked into it and I discovered he'd been writing these articles for almost 20 years, and nobody in the mainstream media was willing to publish them. I mean, we're talking about a Pulitzer Prize-winning former New York Times journalist, one of the most highly regarded journalists in the United States. He'd spent years amassing a mountain of evidence for what could be considered easily the scandal of the century. I mean, the fact that America abandoned its POWs after the Vietnam War ended, and nobody was willing to publish it. And in fact, then, at that time, I was the publisher of the American Conservative, you know, sort of a print publication. And when I came across the stuff, it was just astonishing. Spent some time really doing due diligence on it. I checked his references. I checked everything. I spent quite a lot of time with him on the phone. I talked with some other people. And, you know, all of the evidence was that what he said was entirely true. So we're talking about a gigantic scandal. We published it as a cover story in our magazine. And, you know, normally we got a lot of responses. In fact, afterwards I heard from a few people that they were just utterly shocked by the story when they encountered it. I mean, it was just amazing to them. And they thought, you know, once they read it, once they looked at all the facts, it probably was true. But nobody would say a word about it. And, you know, it's the sort of thing when you find when somebody of that credibility, of that mainstream media credibility, comes across such a gigantic scandal of that type and tries to get it published, and goes around to all these different publications, and nobody will run it because it's considered too controversial. I mean, you really start to be much, much more suspicious of the sort of mainstream media narrative that you're getting on all sorts of other issues. And the media, in effect, creates our reality. I'll give you one example. That was about 10 years ago. I was speaking on a panel, and as it happened, there were, you know, a few other people on the panel with me. And I, you know, just in the talk, I sort of briefly mentioned the, you know, the whole issue of the Vietnam POWs and Sidney Schoenberg and, you know, the amazing sort of stuff he'd done. And, you know, the other people on the panel, I mean, this is crazy. They'd never heard a word about it. We're talking about, you know, mainstream journalists or, you know, leading whistleblowers. I mean, for example, you know, the Pentagon paper, the guy who released the Pentagon papers, boy, this is not my day for names. Obviously very prominent, the guy who leaked the Pentagon papers.
Daniel Ellsberg.
Yeah. Daniel Ellsberg was on the panel with me. And he'd never heard, you know, he was, again, the great leaker of Vietnam secrets. You know, he was the one who leaked the Pentagon Papers. He was plugged in with all of this stuff. And he'd never heard the story about the POWs that Sidney Schoenberg had been trying to get out there for decades. So actually, I had one of the offprints of Sidney Schoenberg's long piece with me. So, you know, he came up to me and I gave him a copy of it. And he ended up reading it that afternoon. And when he came up to me at the reception that evening, he said, "My God, it's clearly true." I mean, he hadn't heard about it for... You know, it had been 50 years before. And Daniel Ellsberg, the great leaker, the person who knew all the secrets, he hadn't been aware of it. So, you know, when you control the media, the vast majority of all of us get our understanding of the world from the mainstream media, even if in certain areas we may differ from the media, we may sort of get our understanding from, you know, other sources. The media still holds the center. And, you know, especially prior to the coming of the internet, prior to the coming of social media and YouTube. And so, you know, if you control the media, you can shape the perceptions of everybody in such a way that you can simply turn black into white. And I mean, that's really, in a sense, what I've tried to do in my very long American Pravda series, focus on all these different issues where the media and the picture of reality given by the media is obviously very different from what I discovered once I really started investigating the issue. And you know, that's sort of what I've been spending most of the last few years on.
What factors do you believe have contributed to the rise of people delving into the realm of historical revisionism and other alternative perspectives to the court-dominated historical narrative?
Well, I think a lot of it is that once a few events come along that sort of break through your wall of disbelief, you become much more open to other things. I mean, in my case, it really was, you know, the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. In other words, when we then ended up attacking Iraq and saying that they had weapons, you know, all the media outlets uniformly said, Iraq, Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, even though I assume that he did have some weapons of mass destruction, some WMDs, I was absolutely opposed to the Iraq war. And, you know, a lot of other people I very much respected felt the same way. I mean, the fact that the American people were somehow snookered into believing that Saddam had something to do with the 9/11 attacks just shows how easy it is to shape the narrative if you control the media. In fact, at the time we ended up attacking Iraq, some of the polls showed that 70% of the American public believed that Saddam Hussein had attacked us on 9/11, 70%. And so, you know, I was totally opposed to the Iraq war, but I did believe that, you know, the media was at least reporting reality and that he had some weapons of mass destruction. And when I discovered he had no such weapon, and very many people in the government had known that, and a certain number of people in the media had known that, but it had all been concocted, that obviously made me much, much more skeptical of many other things. And, you know, more recently, for example, when you have a lot of the Trump supporters, you know, who are just outraged over the Russiagate hoax that was used against him. Or, you know, this whole notion, I mean, the fact that there was that big riot or demonstration on January 6th, and it was portrayed as some crazy attempt to overthrow the government, an insurrection, which obviously wasn't. You had, you know, all these protesters going into the Capitol and wandering around and something like that. I mean, to really declare that the equivalent of a coup d'etat was just ridiculous. So that obviously made many of the Trump people become much, much more suspicious of the media. So, you know, once you've broken the sort of wall of disbelief in enough places, you certainly become much more open to other things. And then when you have, for example, the video available on YouTube or on Rumble or on Twitter video or some of maybe other outlets, I mean, that really, you know, you can take, for example, the Napolitano show, which I watch very regularly. I mean, Jeffrey Sachs and John Mearsheimer are two of the highest-ranking mainstream academics in America, period. I mean, to some extent, even in the world. And the fact that they were totally purged from the mainstream media because of their discordant views on these foreign policy issues, you know, is just exactly what I was talking about regarding the 1940s. Or take someone like Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern spent, I think, 28 years in the CIA. He was the president's morning briefer. He was the CIA official who came in every morning and briefed the president on what intelligence results there were. And I think he briefed six separate presidents. And the fact that he has no public presence in the American media and he's on YouTube, I mean, it's exactly the same thing. Let's take someone like Chaz Freeman, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, one of America's most highly regarded mainstream diplomats. He, very early in his career, at the beginning of his career, he was the translator for Richard Nixon when Richard Nixon went to China to meet with Mao and the other Chinese leaders. He was the young translator. I mean, he's been ambassador to Saudi Arabia, assistant secretary of defense. I mean, he basically has held all these top-ranking positions. He's one of America's most highly regarded former diplomats. And again, he's on YouTube, but no one in the media would ever put him on. And in fact, in the case of Jeffrey Sachs, there was one very funny case about 3 years ago. After America destroyed the Nord Stream pipelines, he was invited on Bloomberg regarding something else. And, you know, somebody asked him something about the Nord Stream pipelines. And he said, well, of course, America destroyed the Nord Stream pipelines. And they yanked him off the air. And he's never been invited on any mainstream media outlet since then. So, you know, it's just, I mean, the whole thing is, fortunately, with something like YouTube, I, you know, can watch all these individuals just as much as I would have more than if they were, you know, on 5-minute segments on CNN or any of the other cable channels. But I mean, it really shows you how dishonest and corrupt the mainstream media is that, you know, some of these very influential, high-ranking individuals are only available on private YouTube channels.
It seems, based on what I could gather from what you've said and also from what I've read in your works, that you believe that social media and the alternative media ecosystem that it has sprouted is the future, though I've heard some people argue that the alternative media and social media, while it has been generally a net good, there's still some residual elements of it that can be kind of subversive. And some people have pointed out that the quote-unquote regime has figured a way to get into these spaces and kind of like pollute the spaces with disinformation, misinformation, and several bad faith actors to kind of poison the well. Have you seen any evidence of that in this new era of like alternative and like social media dominated kind of media complexes?
Oh, I think that's exactly the case. In other words, you know, obviously when social media first appeared, it took a while for the establishment to really decide how to handle it. And I mean, for example, Donald Trump's 2016 election, I think, was largely because of social media, and it shocked the establishment. So there's certainly been a crackdown. In other words, you know, obviously there were mass deplatformings, purges, everything like that. I mean, so many YouTube channels were, you know, canceled or purged or whatever you want to call it. So, I mean, there's been a lot of that. And also, just as you say, there's an effort to sort of infiltrate disinformation, sort of basically a lot, put a lot of smoke and nonsense out there to sort of cover up the more accurate information. So, I mean, that's certainly a problem. So, I mean, I personally, I don't actually use social media much myself. In other words, I occasionally look at tweets, but I don't tweet much myself. And with YouTube, I mean, there are a few channels I follow fairly carefully, but I don't browse around YouTube that much. So I'm not somebody who really spends that much time on social media. But social media does provide at least a channel, a distribution channel of information, which is more than we would have had 30 years ago with, you know, just the mainstream television networks and the major newspapers. I mean, again, the point I sometimes make to people is in the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s and 1970s, there were really a very, very limited number of media outlets in the United States. And if you gain control of those, you really gain control of effectively all of the media. And so that really, when some of these writers I'm talking about, you know, say Harry Elmer Barnes, John T. Flynn, I mean, they were very prominent people. But when they lost their purchase in the publications they'd written for, when they were purged from those publications, it was very, very difficult for them to regain any sort of audience. In other words, how could they? In other words, you know, there were a limited number of magazines and news outlets, and if none of them would be willing to publish their words, I mean, what could they do? So it was sometimes took them years or even decades to regain any sort of media visibility again. Now, in the case today, obviously, you know, people have to be very cautious about, you know, all the sort of nonsense or disinformation floating around on social media. But at least, you know, the information is available and you can find it if you hunt around. While 30 or 40 years ago, that just wasn't the case at all. And, you know, in the case of, for example, these channels, I mean, there are a few YouTube channels I really tend to regard as fairly reliable. It's not so much the channel itself. It's the sort of individuals who appear on that channel that I have a high regard for. So I listen to them. I follow their work. And, I mean, that really is what I'm looking for. In other words, it's not so much that, you know, I've never used Facebook. I've barely ever used Twitter. I've barely used any of these other things. But give you one counterexample. In the case of, for example, the Gaza war, you know, the Israeli attack on Gaza, one reason the establishment encountered so many difficulties was that ordinary Americans, especially younger Americans, were on TikTok. They were on Twitter. They could see the incredible devastation being inflicted by the Israeli military. You know, all these bodies, horrible scenes of destruction, children being killed. And, you know, if not for social media, if not for relatively uncensored social media, nobody would have been aware of that. In other words, if all people knew about what was happening on the other side of the world came from the mainstream television channels or from the newspapers or from the magazines, nobody would have been aware of any of that. And so that's actually the main reason, obviously, there was, you know, there's been an effort to ban TikTok, because TikTok refused to impose the censorship that some of these other social media platforms were willing to impose. And that made, you know, a huge political difference. So, I mean, you know, overall, I'm not somebody who uses social media. I think a lot of the stuff on social media is nonsense. You know, maybe 95% of the stuff on social media is nonsense. But at least it does allow people who want to find important information to be able to do so, which is more than would have been the case otherwise.
One point that you brought up in one of your articles and also in an interview with a Chinese YouTube channel that I found eye-opening is that you proclaimed that America is in a pre-revolutionary moment. By what do you mean, what, pre-revolutionary in that case?
Well, I think, I mean, if you look at, for example, the last few years in American society, I mean, first of all, you know, a very sizable fraction of the American population is not doing well economically. I mean, basically, they're struggling. And you know, the costs, for example, of, you know, so many basic perceived necessities, including healthcare, including rent. I mean, it just, a lot of the American public is in a very difficult position. And, you know, that has been reflected in American politics. I mean, take, for example, the election of Donald Trump. If somebody would have told you 30 years ago, in 2000, I'm talking about the 2016 election, if somebody would have told you 30 years ago that someone who'd never held high political office in the United States or any political office in the United States, who was basically a reality TV star, who had tremendous political baggage, who said all these outrageous things constantly, and was opposed by probably 98% of the American media, plus the political establishments of both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, would successfully defeat both of those political establishments, overcome the enormous influence of the entire American media, be out, I think he was outspent like 2-1 or 3-1. I mean, you know, Hillary Clinton had vastly more money. And, you know, with all of that, would end up being elected president of the United States. I mean, that would have just been the most bizarre and unusual thing you could imagine. I mean, nothing like that had ever previously happened in American history. And now, you know, with Donald Trump, with the establishment doing everything to destroy Donald Trump, I mean, they basically were trying to send him to prison. They were trying to bankrupt him and send him to prison once they finally got him out of office again. And, you know, again, the fact that Trump lost the 2020 election, I mean, there were a lot of very odd things that happened in the election. I mean, notably including the fact that the media hid the fact that Hunter Biden's laptop proved that Biden was involved in one of the worst corruption schemes in American history. In other words, if the media had simply done what it normally would be expected to do and allow people to learn the truth of Hunter Biden's laptop and those corruption schemes, I mean, Trump would have been reelected in a landslide. So, I mean, by any reasonable standard, you have to say that the election was stolen from Donald Trump in 2020. In other words, there are a lot of things about Donald Trump I don't like, but it was stolen from him in 2020. And to have Donald Trump then, you know, be prosecuted, he was convicted, I think, of 4 felonies, or at least charged with 4 felonies. Massive efforts were made to deplatform him. He was banned from Twitter. I mean, the president of the United States was purged from Twitter, which is just unbelievable. It almost sounds like a joke. And with all of that, to have him then win re-election, the only person since, I guess it was Grover Cleveland, who won re-election with two non-consecutive terms and did so against, again, a massive opposition of the entire establishment on the other side. It just shows the tremendous dissatisfaction among so much of the American public. I don't know. It's hard for me to say what fraction of the people who voted for Donald Trump voted for him and what fraction voted against the people he was opposing, the establishment of the Democratic Party and also the establishment of the Republican Party. So, I mean, we're talking about a tremendous amount of dissatisfaction. And, you know, Donald Trump then came in promising to end the Ukraine war, promising to fix all these problems. And, you know, the way things are going, I don't see much sign of the Ukraine war ending in 24 days or even 24 weeks or maybe even 24 months. I mean, you know, apparently the whole situation is still continuing. So, you know, with that and with Trump now possibly on the verge of starting a new war against Iran and also rattling sabers against China, plus the fact that his tariffs may cause a major spike in inflation. I mean, you know, if the economic problems become very severe the way a lot of people think they are, I mean, you really are talking about the sort of destabilization of American politics that, you know, is typically what happens in a pre-revolutionary environment. I mean, again, in effect, Donald Trump almost represents a revolution in American society. And if Donald Trump fails, in other words, if the war continues, if he fails to do the things that he's promised to do, which is why people put him in office in the first place, if the economy goes south, you know, if the stock market collapses, if a lot of these stock market bubbles are discovered to be bubbles the way they are, I mean, look at all the hundreds of billions of dollars being pumped into AI right now. I mean, it's what's been driving up the stock market. And the Chinese just came out with an ultra low cost alternative that's open source that probably most people will switch over to, which means that all these hundreds of billions of dollars may have been entirely wasted. So, you know, when you're talking about those sorts of developments, I mean, at some point, we may really see a destabilization of our society. You probably remember Daniel Patrick Moynihan. You know, very sort of highly regarded senator. In fact, supposedly he had a drinking problem, but people would say even while drunk, he was smarter than all the other senators while sober. And so Daniel Patrick Moynihan, back, I think it was about 20 years ago, I read one of his books where he pointed out that from the time of European settlement on the North American continent, every generation has done economically better than the previous generation for hundreds of years. And around 1970, that ended. In other words, for the last two generations and more than two generations, ordinary Americans have economically stagnated. In other words, their standard of living in many ways has declined. I mean, certain things are much more out of reach. A lot of Americans are terribly in financial debt. I mean, they're going in, you know, terrible debt to, you know, send their children to college and everything like that. I mean, people are doing much less well in many respects than their parents or their grandparents did. And that's unprecedented in American society. I mean, there are many other countries around the world where that's certainly been the case and expected to be the case, but that's never been the case in the United States. And that's clearly one of the reasons there was so much hostility towards the American establishment and support for a total outsider like Donald Trump. And if those problems continue under Trump, and if Trump is blamed because of some of his crazy economic policies for accentuating those problems, then I think you might see some, you know, dramatic things happening in American society. And that's also partly as people lose faith in the media. In other words, if people start to believe that they've been lied to, that their parents were lied to, that for generations, what they've been taught about American history is false. When you combine that with their very high levels of dissatisfaction with their own daily lives, I mean, you could be talking about a very explosive mix. And I mean, that's when you look at other countries around the world that have gone through a sort of upheaval. those are the sorts of telling signs that you've seen there. And I mean, in American society, I mean, you know, so long as people are doing reasonably all right economically, I mean, so long as there isn't, you know, mass poverty, then I'm not saying that necessarily will happen. But I really do believe that our economy is very fragile right now. And, you know, when we have gigantic budget deficits, gigantic trade deficits, when one of the reasons our standard of living is able to be maintained the level it is because the dollar is the international reserve currency. In other words, we're getting products from all across the world that people can use and take. And in exchange, we're simply giving them paper IOUs or electronic IOUs. If at some point that situation changes, then you could see a tremendous collapse in the American standard of living. And at that point, I think a lot of these issues might come to the fore.
Oh, yes. I definitely see something on the horizon as well, because with this so-called like Doge and this consortium of big tech oligarchs ranging from like Larry Ellison to Elon Musk congregating around Trump, there's going to be some type of backlash towards the rich. And the only thing that's missing is like one final shoe to drop, whether it's like a stagflationary collapse or some type of economic reversal or even a military reversal abroad.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. I mean, take, for example, we're fighting a proxy war with Russia on Russia's own border, which is just utterly insane. In other words, nobody during the old Cold War would have possibly considered doing something like that. We're also, according to many accounts, possibly considering another war with Iran in the Middle East. And, you know, I mean, according to a lot of military experts, I'm not a military expert, but I mean, there's a lot of very knowledgeable people who seem to think that our aircraft carriers are extremely vulnerable to missiles, hypersonic missiles in particular, but even just ordinary ballistic missiles. So if, for example, we get into another war and we ended up losing one or more of our aircraft carriers in a war that we started, I mean, when you look at, for example, the Russian Revolution of 1905, I mean, it happened because basically the Russian fleet was destroyed by the Japanese. It was defeated by Japan. And that caused such a, I mean, the notion of being defeated by a relatively weak, perceived weak power like that was just outrageous. And it caused, you know, an uprising and overthrow of the regime. And so, you know, if we're talking about people being very, very dissatisfied with the American government and American society in all sorts of different ways, the fact that America spends almost as much money on its military as the rest of the world combined, I think we have something like 40% or more than 40% of the world's entire military spending. And if we end up suffering some severe military reversal, which certainly could happen, I think there'll be a tremendous amount of anger and hostility at our government for having put us in this situation. In other words, having wasted our money on these foolish efforts that basically, and also, for example, if there's a war in the Middle East, it could cause a huge spike in oil prices. And so, you know, what happens when gasoline goes up to $10 a gallon or something like that? I mean, a lot of people right now living paycheck to paycheck. And if suddenly, you know, gasoline becomes unaffordable, I mean, that could be an utter disaster for our society. And people would, I think, then blame the establishment and, you know, Trump and, you know, all of these different groups that have been running the country. And, you know, the results could be very unpleasant.
You know, I agree. It's very sobering stuff. And we are definitely heading into uncharted waters for sure. But yeah, we've already hit the 1 hour mark, Ron, but I really enjoyed this discussion. But before we leave, could you let our audience know where they can follow your latest work?
Sure. Our website is the UNS Review. It's UNS.com. You can go there. And we basically provide a very wide range of alternative perspectives, left wing, right wing, libertarian, all sorts of different views on there. In other words, you know, our motto is, you know, if it's an important controversial view that's not allowed in the mainstream media, that's the sort of thing that we'd like to publish on our website. And all of my articles are there, grouped into various different cases. And so I think, people would probably find a lot of stuff that they would disagree with, but possibly a lot of stuff that they would also agree with. And they would, that's basically what our publication does.
Great stuff. Again, Ron, thank you for taking the time out of your day for this discussion. And to the audience, thank you for tuning in for the Barnes Review History Hour. This is Jose Nino signing out.